Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Makone Maja. Makone, how are you doing?
Hello, and Happy New Year. This is my first time back on the show, so hope nobody's gotten tired of hearing compliments of the new season wished upon them. So, compliments.
No, very much well taken. Thank you very much. And Anlu Kiva. Anlu, how are you doing?
I'm also doing well. Thank you, Nicholas. It's my first time back as well. So excited to be back.
Fantastic. Fantastic. All right. Before we get into the show, let me just quickly read a word from our sponsor, Hideco Energy. Hideco Energy says, are you tired of skyrocketing electricity bills and the new phenomenon of load reduction? Meet Hideco Energy, South Africa's trusted tier one premium solar and backup power solution supplier. With over 100 years of trading experience and the backing of a publicly listed company, Hideco Energy brings you the best quality international products to power your home or business reliably. From 3 kilowatt single phase systems to 250 kilowatt three phase solutions, we've got our own options for every need. And here's the best part. We offer unbeatable financing and rent-to-own packages designed to lower the barriers to saving money, cutting electricity costs, and ensuring power stability, regardless of what's happening at Eskom. Right now, we're thrilled to offer Daily Friend listeners an exclusive promotion. Book a free business or household audit, and we'll show you how to put more money back into your pocket without hefty upfront costs. Reach out to them at sales@hidecoenergy.co.za by email. That's Hideco Energy is Hudaco Energy, one word. Or call them at 011-447-9864. Hideco Energy, sustainable power and storage solutions provider. Okay, let us get into the stories of today. And the first thing we're going to talk about is Solidarity and AfriForum are going to be taking on the Bella Bill. So, quick recap. Apologies for those of you who have already seen, heard all of this before, but it's important to remember where we are. The Bella Bill is a bill which does a number of things, but one of the most controversial parts of the bill is that it essentially centralizes decision-making not in school governing bodies, which are close to the ground and actually involved in schools, but in provincial education departments on two key issues. One is language policy, and the other one is admissions policy. Now, seeing how sort of, I don't know what to call them, but politician, activist, crusader types looking to make hay have abused their powers in the education department. Often this has led to concerns that the centralizing this power in the provincial education departments will lead to the abuses, particularly of Afrikaans schools, but also maybe government schools attempting to sort of, or the department attempting to force lots of kids into well-performing schools, which they don't have the capacity to handle. There's lots of negative consequences that could come from this. The DA originally said that it was very opposed to this legislation. It said that it was a red line for it within the Government of National Unity. President Ramaphosa initially said after signing the bill that he would suspend the two contentious clauses of the bill until a compromise could be worked out on those two contentious parts. And then in December, after much negotiations and back and forth, the DA said that it had agreed to this and that this thing was going into full effect, but that they would produce a number of regulations that would limit essentially the potential for abuse with these two contentious clauses. So that's where we stand now. And initially I was looking at the response from AfriForum, who had been very aggressive against the Bella Bill. They said that you know, anyone who tried to implement the bill before the regulations were drawn up would be in contravention of the act. And now they've decided that it looks like they're going to be taking the whole thing to court. They have given the president and minister 10 days to explain their action of the promulgation, saying that it was incorrect. AfriForum CEO Kali Creel said the promulgation was an act of aggression by government against Afrikaans schools and children. The promulgation indicates that the ANC is busy turning the GNU into the government of national disagreement that aims to co-opt parties like the DA and the Freedom Front Plus to help the ANC carry out its policy. And of course, the Minister of Basic Education is Siviwe Gorube, who is from the DA. Makone, big messy thing now. Interesting that AfriForum decided to go all in on this one. What do you make of the story?
Yeah, I think Bella is the case of biting one's nose to spite one's face as I've ever seen one in South African politics. Basically, the short-term hatred for Afrikaans and it being traded in for long-term forfeiting of parental autonomy over schools. I do think that we will endure the consequences of that eventually. The chickens always come back. I was thinking that perhaps the minister, intentionally or unintentionally, you were leaning on the more unintentionally, Nick, but that she teed this up. She teed the storm up when she signed the agreement, brokered the agreement with Solidarity at NEDLAC, because that would then force any implementation of the act to be considered irrational, as Solidarity and AfriForum are now alleging, right? That seems to be the sole basis of their case. I'm not sure. I'm just going off of Solidarity statement on their website that they released that it is irrational for the minister to broker this agreement and then go on to sign the promulgation. Those two things contradict each other. That this deal that they signed 1 week later is now being appended through the full implementation of the act, and that the minister's fingerprints are all over this. She set this up effectively, whether she intended to or not. But I was also hoping that this case would be challenged on a constitutional basis, because the constitution does make provision for all South African learners to receive education in their mother tongue. Yet that does not seem to be included in Solidarity's case. I'm not sure why. The whole thing seems to me to hinge, and I stand to be corrected, but it seems to hinge solely on that NEDLAC agreement. So the conspiracy theorists may think that this was intentional. Nicholas, you seem to disagree, and I'm keen to hear more of what you have to say about that and how the DA typically operates. But the minister definitely set this one up.
Yeah, so my general gut feeling is that the DA, they're very much, particularly at the highest levels, a kind of rules is rules type of party. So, you know, sort of intentionally sabotaging themselves like that, I think is not really their style. But, you know, don't put it past politicians to innovate in interesting and new ways. You know, the thing in this bill for me that I think the Afrikaans stuff is to a certain degree a little bit of distraction from what is the big core principled problem of this bill, which is that it takes power away from people who are invested in a particular school, that is the school governing body, that is the parents, that is, you know, the teachers and principals and that, and it vests it in a provincial department official who may know absolutely nothing about the school for which they're promulgating issues and orders for. We don't know, you know, the potential for abuse here or just simply misgovernance, I think, is very high. And this is exactly the wrong direction which South Africa should be taking its policy. Too often we see the ANC try to centralize all decision-making to the highest levels possible, and this inevitably leads to a large number of problems. I mean, one of which is just quite often you'll find that regulations, legislation, decisions don't get made because you have a huge backlog of stuff that still needs to be done. So I think the potential abuse for this, or just simply misgovernance by provincial officials, is very high. Andrew, what's your take on this? You know, Bella is definitely damaging to the education system, and I think, what's your take on the DA's sort of response here?
Nicholas, if I can have a quick moment of reflection, I think I personally know of schools where what was previously called, well, a musiekkamer, it would translate, I suppose, to a music room, is being used as classrooms. And that is simply because of the lack of space and the lack of teachers, teachers not actually having a schedule that they can stick to. It's perhaps in some cases even too full. And I think that gives us a good indication of what the current situation in schools is and what it's being operated as at the moment. And if that is the basis to go from, I think it's very scary what will happen. And I think it's important to perhaps just a little bit of context, well, rather just to add some context to what Makone also said is, so AfriForum acknowledged, that they know the NEDLAC agreement that they had wasn't binding. So the fact that that was still made and that the minister made that gives a little bit of an indication that perhaps there is an opportunity for me to, as you mentioned before, to grab my tinfoil hat and to kind of put it on here. It's perhaps not as unlikely as I kind of actually hope it's true. It would be a bit more drama and I'm here for it. And then I think, so it's possible that this wasn't the hill that they wanted to die on. They're saving up a little bit of the energy for the battle that lies ahead, NHI being one of them. So I think the very important next step that we need to focus on here is to continue emphasizing, as you said, it's a regressive step. This, it's not a step in the right direction. And the image that comes to mind for me, at least, is like a tug of war over control in the classroom. And if you continue pulling and the ANC has their end at least tied around a pole, yeah, it's a little bit of a hard tug to win. And then, of course, if I can just ask one last little thing, I'm talking long, is that I think very little attention was actually given to the financial implications of much of this act. I take, for example, if grade R's across the board, which it is now, is mandatory, it'll cost at least an additional 18 billion rand. And this is just for the physical infrastructure and for the teachers. And we obviously know about wage agreements and wage negotiations. But yeah, so the financial implications of this is another aspect that I think definitely needs to see a little bit more light today.
Yeah, I do think that that is something that's definitely not been properly discussed. And I do think that it should have been in the public because so much of the attention was focused on the very contentious clauses. Although the argument made by sort of defenders of the bill, and a lot of people seem to agree on this across the political spectrum, is that early childhood development is so important that making grade R compulsory is probably a good thing. Although, you know, as you say, whether we actually have the capacity to do so at the moment is another question entirely. Makone, any final thoughts on this one before we move on?
One of your points strongly resonates with me, Nick, about how this conversation has gotten bogged down into language policy as almost the defining principle that like defines the tension within Bella in its entirety. And I've just observed how, at least in my circles, people feel, oh, this is not my fight if it's about Afrikaans because I'm not Afrikaans speaking, and have just opted out of it because of how the conversation's being framed. But I do know that a lot of us incoming parents, millennials, Gen Z, and the rest want to have a say in our children's education. And we're watching that being taken out of our hands and how that can shape the school's performances. More often than not, the performance of a child really vests in the parent's investment in their child and ensuring that child's success. And Bella basically does away with that and hands it over potentially to another SATU or trade union cadre. So I agree with you that the framing of a conversation has limited interest and entry into it because people have just sort of sat on the sidelines. They don't see where they come into the conversation yet, which has been a hugely missed opportunity, specifically for the youth who are incoming parents.
Right. And of course, this benefits the sort of ANC, Panyaza Lesufi, EFF, MK bloc, which is if the issue here is Afrikaans in schools rather than government overreach and taking power away from parents, you can then try and redefine the entire disagreement is some kind of racial fight, right? It's like, oh, you see the whites are just trying to keep the good schools for themselves or something like that, which is exactly the way that this discussion should not be had, because it's not true and it is counterproductive. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that one before we move on the corner.
No, absolutely. They've sort of put like blinders on us to focus on this specific issue of Afrikaans and how Afrikaans speakers are white, despite that the fact that most Afrikaans speakers in the country anyway are probably colored. But still, it's been a very effective way of framing the conversation so that they keep our attention at one area of the bella to the neglect of the bigger, wider context, which is parental autonomy going up against government overreach.
Exactly. Okay, let's go on to a story that's from a little bit earlier in the week, and that is that the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, which is run by Vilakosini Klabisa from the IFP, said this week that due to budget constraints, it was going to be firing 60,000 temporary workers who were part of a community work program who were aged 55 and older, so basically sort of, you know, kind of towards retirement age. These temporary work programs give people employment via the government to do just kind of basic tasks, you know, like cleaning roads or assisting with things, just do like unskilled stuff. It's very much a kind of make work scheme for people who are very desperate and very poor. Very often these things are quite corrupt, unfortunately. They end up being traded out for money, for bribes, for sex, for all sorts of problems like that. They can also be abused for political patronage purposes, which is, you know, you find that the person who gets appointed to decide who gets the jobs in the community also tends to be the sort of the ANC branch chair or something, and then it all gets handed out to people around him. So there are a lot of problems with schemes like this, and they're unfortunately a lifeline for quite a few South Africans. However, the COCTA department, after furious backlash, particularly from the unions, particularly from, I think, Kasatu was very upset, has now had a discussion with the finance department and said, hey, okay, well, you know, maybe we can actually keep these people employed for a while more and find something else, some other way to cut the money. But Anlu, this really does seem like the sort of the status quo, which is that the state has been turned into this giant patronage machine, is running up against the fact that the fiscal reality is not as rosy as it once was. What do you make of this?
The massive banner I want to hang over this is that it's not the role of the government to create jobs. And the moment the government actually takes on that position to, instead of focusing on creating an environment that enables more job opportunities, to actually directly create those job opportunities, they'll inevitably come to this point. And I think, so for me, it's at least just one big basic accounting exercise. And the reason I'm saying that is, so what I predict at least will happen to much of these, say in this instance, 60,000 people, is that they'll simply be moved from one ledger of government to another. I mean, many of these people, it's as you said, they're low skilled. It's just very desperate people looking for something to do, government trying to kind of help them out. But they're already part of this project or program because they're struggling to find another job. So these people aren't entering into the labor force and going directly into another job. There's months of joblessness and unemployment lying ahead for them. And with that, I'm not saying that the government should now step up and say, as they did, extend it by 2 months, to say, okay, but we'll extend it again. That's not the idea. I understand that this will happen, but it basically just reemphasizes that the main focus of government should be to create long-term job opportunities. This should have been expected. And I think to some extent it was expected. But yeah, it's definitely not the responsibility of government. It's as you said that, again, it's one of those instances where policy doesn't align with the finances that we have available. And I think at the end of the day, we'll sit with government having to pay for two types of people, the new entrants into those positions now being left vacant, and also the people now dependent on the government.
It's what's extra tragic about this is the fact that this one specifically targeted in this mass layoff are very old people. So essentially, this is just kind of like a pension supplement. And considering how low our pensions are in this country, I can see why people would be willing to take these opportunities. I mean, when you're looking at workers over the age of 55, when you're looking at low-skilled work for people over the age of 55, there isn't that much you can do, which is I think also reveals the degree to which this is actually, in a lot of ways, just a kind of a bit of a welfare scheme for, I think, quite a few people. Very tragic that this is what people have to rely on for their income. But Makone, any additional thoughts?
Yeah, I tend to agree with Anlu there. I think that one way in which government should consider taking risk in terms of job creation is in making the investment in infrastructure, basically creating conditions for business to thrive. That way, business takes up all the risk in creating jobs and even in the job losses. But obviously, the government has to create very favorable conditions from electricity to logistics, you name it. I am generally not a fan of these government job creation programs, from this one, CWP, to the DPWP, the Department of Public Works version, to the SETAs. So many times there are perverse incentives baked into them. There was reporting done on this, I believe, by Ama Bungani, where it was reporting that this CWP program is basically run by something like 10 or 11 nonprofit organizations, and that they get awarded all the tenders basically, and that three of them operate like a mafia. That even though they get awarded all the tenders and they themselves have a budget that's assigned to them, which means that they have to then procure like uniforms for the workers, various other things for the workers to be able to do their job, they don't actually follow government regulation on how to procure goods. For example, those opportunities usually go to friends and family. And so you've described it aptly, Nick, as sort of a force for patronage. And now that that's being taken away, the loudest screams are coming from the biggest benefactors of patronage networks in South Africa, typically been the unions. And yeah, I'm generally not a fan. Some of the other perverse incentives that are created is that they limit how much money you can actually make, right? Specifically the CWP one, there was a case, I believe, in 2020 where the workers were alleging that the program is basically going through their statements and ensuring that they're not able to earn above the threshold that cuts them off from earning the stipend that the CWP program allows them to make. So if CWP can only pay you 3,700 rand a month, and you go out there and try to get other jobs so that you can supplement that income, just like with a social grant, like there's a cut off for how much you can make. If you try to go out there and get another job, you get cut off the program. We want people in South Africa to have the desire to go and get work. They already do, right? But government creates all of these artificial barriers for them to be able to seek work and employment and to ultimately live dignified lives and trying to provide for their families, which the government simultaneously stops, but it wants them to work and it wants to pay them a stipend, but not enough so that they can live reasonably good lives. It's very frustrating how these programs come into effect. The idea can be good, and the principle can be like amiable, but if in application it only limits how much money people can actually make, which it's a terrible thing, then I think we should scrap them altogether, or at least reform them so that there's more private sector involvement. But obviously, you'd have to negotiate things like minimum wage, and the government's never going to give up that bone, right? So yeah, all around, very frustrating. I generally detest these government works programs. They are big failures, and just like the one that Banyaza Lesufi was operating in Johannesburg. I think that's the fate of many of them, especially now with the fiscus and fiscal issues we have in South Africa.
Anlu, any concluding thoughts?
Not much, Nicholas. The only thing I'd add is that I agree with Makone in the sense that government creating jobs in terms of building up infrastructure, those type of jobs have multiplier effects. And if they can actually create those type of jobs, it also creates more jobs. So in that sense, I definitely think that's the one area where government can come in and say, okay, we need people to actually do the jobs. Let's create the jobs, and they'll move on from there onto the next opportunity. It's not a permanent solution.
No, exactly right. It's helping people to buy food for the next week. It's not helping people to change their lives and actually get out of poverty. Okay, let's finish off with a somewhat more amusing story, although it's also got fairly dark elements to it. But anyway, a KZN burial group backed Zuma has cried betrayal because the MK party is apparently looking at setting up its own funeral society. So in South Africa, funerals are very big business. People spend a lot of money on them. People often insure themselves against death and pay money in to make sure that there's enough money to cover their funeral. And as a result, there's a lot of money that to be made in this sector. Members of a funeral business group are now, apparently, according to media reports, crying foul at an apparent betrayal by Jacob Zuma's party. The Unification Task Team of the Funeral Industry of South Africa, whose spokesperson is Mzi Hluengwa, claimed some of its members had backed MK very aggressively and now were outraged to see that the party seemed to be trying to compete with them. The business is supposed to be called Mkhonto Isizwe Funerals, which is just so, I don't know. I don't know if I would want my political party associated with death, but whatever. There were apparently plans to launch it last year, but it's not clear if this has happened yet. Hluengwa says, who owns his own funeral parlor, said that the organization stopped the ANC when it was considering a similar proposal a few years ago, and that they were engaging with MK to prevent them entering their business space, but, quote, MK is stalling. Hluengwa is a close personal friend of Jacob Zuma, he says, and that this would not affect his relationship with Jacob Zuma, but he would certainly stop supporting MK if they went ahead and created this funeral program. He said, quote, I don't want to take it personally. Look, to be in favor of the party doesn't mean we must always agree. If I believe one of their policies is not correct, I'll stand up and say so. He said that many funeral business owners had backed the party because it represented black business aspirations, as he described them. And he said that this could escalate political violence in KZN if MK entered into the space. He went on to say, we marched against Old Mutual for a whole week and closed their offices in Durban 2020. They couldn't work. That's how we moved them out of the industry. If MK Party wants us to do it, we'll do it. We'll close all their offices. They won't be able to operate. If they want to kill us, they must go ahead and kill us. Makona, we were discussing this before the show, and I don't think I've ever seen a better example of the mafiaization of so many businesses in South Africa than this story. It's kind of hilarious that, you know, MK is so treacherous as to stab their allies in the back like this. And at the same time, it's so dark in that, you know, this is just another business entering the field. What makes you think you can go and close their offices?
I do think Mr. Hluengwa, as he's named in the article, raises other valid points, like the fact that MK is in parliament and parliament issues laws about business. And obviously, like that there's a glaring conflict of interest there. But I must say, for a party called Mkhonto Isizwe, they sure do have many spears and arrows aimed and fashioned at them. That those threats are terrifying. Yeah. But I would also think, like, one of the first rules of business for political party funding is not to stab your backers in the back. Not to stab your funders in the back, as the spear of the nation is now doing to its very supporters. So I was hoping for evidence of this. Unfortunately, News 24 is beckoning on us to trust them. They claim that they've seen the videos that MK Party filmed in December, speaking about this burial service that they would start. It's not copied into the text. But yeah, I'm surprised at this move by the MK. And one of the things Mr. Hluengwa also raises, Nicholas, is that, if they are to go into the insurance business, they would need an underwriter. And is that not the very white monopoly capital that Jacob Zuma fought so hard against? So Again, another spear that the Mkhonto esizwe is now coming in contact with, many thorns in their flesh. Very interesting to see how they're going to navigate this one, if at all, if they do indeed go ahead with the plans for the Mkhonto esizwe party burial service.
Anlu, you said in the pre-show discussion that this was the most exciting story that we're going to talk about today to you. And I can see why. I mean, MK is just endlessly like a producer of just kind of stories that are sort of so comical. You'd think it was a caricature of them, just as always, like dodgy business connections, people accused of various crimes, just incomprehensible policy. What do you make of this story?
Well, Nicholas, to be honest, when I read the title of this story, my initial thoughts was, what on earth can this be about? Because surely MK is not considering starting a funeral business. Like, it's a play on words or something. It can't be. And in the Afrikaans saying, so waar is vragtig, they are. So yeah, I'm here for the drama, as I said earlier. That's why it's my favorite story. But so it's as you've also mentioned in the quotes that you gave earlier, and I agree with Makone on this, and it also came to front in the interview in Newsstream 4, is that MK can't be the referee and the player, and that's something that the owner also said. And I think it's important to have that distinction. And as you said, Makone, not to kind of the people who fund you, they're the last people you stab in the back. But I think the more important point perhaps here is that this is the issue when you support political parties that are formed out of chaos. And Nicholas, you said in an episode earlier this week that MK is kind of best described as fluid and dynamic. And I think if you focus on a political, or you at least offer your support to a political party who is as chaotic as that, from the start, they've been chaotic, and it's very likely that it will continue. So it's almost the fuel that they run on. And in that sense, yeah, he really is in no position to say that he did not see this coming. I think none of us are. Perhaps not the very specific point of a funeral parlor, but the overstepping, definitely.
Just like, not that I think President Ramaphosa necessarily listens to our show on the daily, but I would just like to remind him that if you push the DA out of the coalition of the ANC, these are your alternative coalition partners. So good luck, guys, because I would not want to be in coalition with MK. I can tell you that much. Utter madness. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We hope that you found the show interesting, exciting, informative, all those good things. If you do, please do subscribe to us. Please give us a like. If you are listening to us on YouTube, we very much appreciate it. Please do share us with your friends, and we will, of course, see you next week. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. Cheers, everyone. Bye-bye.